You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2026 Giro d'Italia.
Buongiorno, Michele Pelacci.
Ciao Daniele, we're back for a final time.
Very final time. Pelacci, this is the leftovers, the dregs leftover, as we say, after the Giro d'Italia. We are a week, not quite a week out from when we said our farewells in Verona. Mm-hmm. Michele, what have you been doing over the last week?
Some other journalistic stuff. I've been writing about the Ticino, the Canton Ticino, where we stayed in the Giro rest day, the final rest day of the Giro with you on the shores of Lago Maggiore, that area in the north of Italy. And yeah, I've been writing some articles about the Giro women, about the World Cup of soccer that's coming up, and all sorts of stuff. Yeah. What about you?
Always in the kitchen. The oven is never off, is it? What about you? Well, I previewed what I'd be doing this week, didn't I, in Sunday's episode, Michele. I've been with my parents for the last week, sort of driving them around Italy. So now we're in Umbria, which has been very nice. We were in sort of Valpolicella, north of Verona, for a few days, and then I drove down on, I think it was Thursday. So yeah, all good, just recovering. Pelacci, from some of the pastings we gave each other on the runs. Not really recovering very well from the Giro d'Italia. Anyway, Pelacci, as promised, I mean, we like to keep our promises where we can. We are back because we got so many fantastic questions over the course of the Giro in the highly successful, I think, interactive part of the podcast that we introduced, the third part of the podcast. Tried to answer questions every day. We only really got to a fraction of them. So we vowed that we would reconvene after the Giro and try and answer some more. I think I initially said we would try to answer all of them. I don't know whether that's going to be realistic because we've got so many, but we're going to give ourselves about 45 minutes now, and we're going to endeavor to answer some more. In the interest of full transparency, we haven't done a lot of research, have we, Michele? You've been doing what you've been doing this week. You've been in the Canton Ticino. I've been on holiday. Some of these questions do require some research, and you will, as listeners, you will probably hear when we respond to some of them that we are heinously underprepared to answer some of them, but we will do our best. We will expose all of our workings and all of our inadequacies in our efforts to respond to these questions. So without further ado, Pelacci, let's go, shall we? You've collected some, I've collected some from various sources, Instagram, direct messages, Strava, etc. So question one from Alex Lebrun on Strava. A question for the podcast. What question would you ask? This is like the ultimate, this is the final boss of questions. But actually, what question would you have asked us on the Giro?
Yeah, it's tough. Because we've been talking about a lot of things on the road and chatting a lot. But I think I would be just curious on the dynamics of how a day goes, right? For example, some people were asking me yesterday, do you guys leave before the race or after the race? How do you go from start to finish? This sort of, the dynamic questions like about, how the race deploys or evolves.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you, Pelacci. I think it was interesting when we stayed with Simon Roberts, a listener of the podcast in Piemonte. I think he got a bit of an insight into how our days work. And I think generally this is not to get the violins out and sort of plead hardship. Far from it. As we know, or as you know, as listeners, and as we communicate often, I think we very much enjoy our time in the Giro. But I think people would be surprised at how frantic it is, the whole day, and how hectic it is and how little time there is, for example, for us to watch the race. And that is why we don't really lean into that. You know, there are people that do that much better than us because, you know, I'll just give one example. The guys that did the Lanterne Rouge podcast, I mean, they sort of pride themselves on watching every race from kilometer zero to the finish line. And we can't do that. Simply, we cannot do that. It's not practically possible. When we try to watch the race, one of us is driving and the other one is sort of fighting with partial network coverage and, you know, there's a wiles of modern technology. So we see sort of snatches of the race. And then when we get to the finish, we're out doing interviews and running around, and often, you know, buses are a kilometer apart and, you know, we have to find riders, we have to find people who are willing to speak to us. And so, you know, in the hour or so after the finish, or 2 hours after the finish, we don't even have time to be sitting down and watching replays. We try to do that as much as possible. But so if you add it all together, there's, you know, we don't get a lot of time to watch the race. So we have to, so what are our strengths when we're there? It's the fact that we are there and we see and we hear it all in 3D. So we have to try to give a offer a different sort of product, a different view of the race, which is why, and I'm sort of, you know, I sort of pride myself or ourselves on the fact that what the podcast that we put out is kind of unrecognizable from the race that people see on the TV. It's almost as though we're talking about two different things. So anyway, that's just to say that our days, I think the rhythm of our days, the cadence of our days, would probably surprise people quite a lot. So I think that would be a good question. Should we move on,
Pilacci? Yeah, we've got too many questions, Daniele. Phil Walsh on Strava asks, it's not cycling related, but he is curious to know what are your trail racing plans for the year. What are they?
I think retirement, Pilacci, after some of the humblings I took on those 20% gradients at your hands. Yeah, I don't know. I'll probably do the Valtellina Wine Trail again in November, although I'm not really sure. Had some illness earlier in the year, and it's taken me a long time to recover, and I just don't feel like I'm recovering this year. So, not very optimistic about my season of trail running, racing. Pilacci, from Yannick on Strava, two questions. Thoughts on why we still don't have openly gay male professional cyclists? Two, what are your favourite riders fitting the following descriptions? The talented rider with great work ethic who just performs to the occasion. The rider who can just suffer the most and dig deeper than the others. The rider who just outsmarts or outwits the others rather than just being the strongest. And as a two-parter, what feat of a rider do you admire or identify with most? The first question is much easier to answer, I suppose, Pilacci. Mm-hmm. Thoughts on why we still don't have an openly gay male professional cyclist? Do you want to go first, Pilacci?
It's tough. I think it's a thing of culture and tradition, and if you look at the numbers, there's probably someone out there who is, right? There are, I don't want to say 1,000 male cyclists, and in a society, if you look at the numbers, you have gay male
dozens. Statistically speaking, there should in theory be dozens. I don't know what the current state of play is in other men's professional sports. I'm trying to think of, so football, there have been very few, but there are some who are openly gay now. In sports like tennis, I'm not an assiduous enough follower of tennis and other sports. I mean, I always sort of try to think of sports just similar in scale, I suppose, or similar in profile. And obviously, that there's a serious underrepresentation there, at least in terms of publicly homosexual athletes, certainly on the men's side. So why not? I mean, I suppose people would say, and I don't, you know, you don't want to be glib about this, but you would say that once one person takes the step to do it, then more will probably follow. And I would suggest that's the case in professional cycling, but it's, you would imagine that it would happen in the next few years, but who knows?
Yep, I will agree. And it's important for someone to do the first step. Speaking of the question on the talented rider with great work ethic who just performs to the occasion, Sepkus is the first name that comes to my mind. A rider who can suffer a lot and dig deeper than the others. I'm going with Elisa Longo Borghini in here, Italian champion. There is the super Colle delle Finestre stage today in the Women's Giro. And the last question is the rider who just outsmarts and outwits the others rather than just being the strongest. I think Michael Wijgren in this year's Giro gave a great example of that. Yeah, these are my answers.
We'll leave it at that, Palachi. You will be our spokesperson on that particular matter. Number five from Ross BT on Strava. Daniel, how are you going to get your usual stock of Rivella? Well, with my own hard-earned money, Ross, this time. And yeah, unfortunately, none of my usual dealers were able to come through this time on the Giro d'Italia, as I've mentioned various times over the years. One of my regular Rivella dealers is Primoz Roglic, and also Jonas Vingegaard's agent, but he's been letting me down for a couple of years now. I did see Mattia a lot at the Giro, but he always sort of apologizes that he hasn't managed to deliver after the infamous incident where once he tried to buy me a case of Rivella six pack, and then his car broke down in Bari in Puglia, and he had to leave the car in Bari in Puglia while he was back in Switzerland. So there was this six pack of Rivella, of blue Rivella, left somewhere stranded in Puglia, and it was never rescued after. And that sort of that seemed to scar Mattia, and he's never tried to satisfy my Rivella cravings since then. But I've got a couple of trips planned to Switzerland over the next few weeks, so I'll be fine. Don't you worry, Ross. From Mark Cooney on Strava, have you guys any suggestions for where to eat, what to see, and anything you would recommend in Turin, Palachi?
I do, Daniele. So three spots to eat, three different spots. So one is in the center, close to where my close friend Alessandro lives. It's called Pour Manger. It's based on potatoes. You can eat potatoes with everything. It's really good. A second spot is at Old Trattoria up the Colle di Superga, just on the sort of, not the top, but there is a turn to the left.
Oh, we know that turn, don't we? We know that turn very well, don't we, Michaela?
Yeah, perfect. It's called the Conserva. Very good trattoria. And the last spot is the Velo Bistro. It's in the velodrome, entitled to Fausto Coppi, close to the monument to Fausto Coppi on the River Po. It's really good. So three places suggested.
Palachi, we ate in Turin last year when we met for the Vuelta. I'm just looking for the name of the restaurant, and we ate somewhere good. If you go to sort of the it's the west of the city, isn't it? More towards Superga, just over the river. This is not very specific, but that area. Let me just see, Palachi. Let me just see what we've got here.
I've got one other tip. To the west of Turin, there is beautiful parks. La Mandria is a very good park. You can have walk or running or biking there.
Scannabue Ristorante was so Scannabue. Palachi, if I'm not mistaken, that when you joined us, the first night you joined us on the Vuelta last year, that was where we ate, and I remember that being pretty good on Largo Saluzzo. Next question. Sorry, go on.
No, just last random fact about Turin. I think Turin hosts the biggest Egyptian museum outside of Egypt. It's the biggest one.
I think Barone went there last year on the years ago when the Giro started there. I think he took himself off for a couple of hours and visited it. Yeah. But a very beautiful city, intriguing city, a city that we've been to many times over the last few years on Grand Tours, on the Giro, the Tour, and the Vuelta. Most memorable thing about those visits, Michele, as well as the sort of the last time we were able to visit our late friend Gianni Savio a couple of years ago at the Giro d'Italia, the runs up Superga, you've been with me twice, I think. You've run up Superga twice or once? Once. But over the course of a couple of years, I was able to run up the climb, the same climb that they do in Milano-Torino now, three times in three different Grand Tours, which was curious. From Peter Newland on Strava, is there an aesthetic quality to ciclismo? How does one look ciclismo, dress ciclismo?
Great question. You just go with the flow. You just go with what you feel. I think that you feel good with, that's ciclismo. So, yeah, it's stamp of approval.
Are there no golden rules, Palacci? Are there no, you know, sort of sock lengths and that kind of thing that people are always getting a froth about?
Nah, I would say anything that even like small details of real ciclismo are appreciated, of course. For example, if you got like a normal, I don't know, shirt or elegant trousers, wear a little, I don't know,
trousers to cycle
or jeans.
To go out and go on a training session to do 4 hours of zone two in a pair of Levi's, Palacci.
Listen, wear just a little, I don't know, yellow bracelet that with the, I don't know, Pantani fan club, just little cycling ciclismo details, right? That's what I want. But I wear all the time.
Palacci, is there going to be a comeback for the very garish, plastered in logos, team kits of the, you know, we saw, well, you still, you tend to see older gentlemen, and it is more gentlemen than women, but older gentlemen in Italy, they will still wear the sort of the 90s team kits, or even local club jerseys with a lot of logos and a lot of color. Do you think we will ever see a comeback for that? Because basically, Palacci, I sort of stopped cycling at a time before the kind of the more sort of stylish, minimalist clothing that is now de rigueur. And sometimes I wonder, if I was to go back to cycling a lot, how would I dress? How would I? Because I always used to wear the old team kits. I used to wear full Mappe kit all the time, Palacci, because I had loads of it because they gave it to me, and that was my team as well. So I sometimes wonder, what would I wear if I started cycling regularly again? But do you think the team kits will ever make a big
interesting? To be honest, I don't think so. If you look at the fact that now the sort of less is more sort of approach is spreading more and more. And I'm connecting this question, this topic, with what Dominic H. asks. He asks, in general, Italians are very stylish. However, it's not uncommon to see a roadie with a backpack in Italy. Can Palacci shed any light on this short talk?
Did we not answer this last week? Did we not answer this last week? No. Maybe in the car we did.
The thing you have to do, is just follow Pannolati on the Instagram. It's this Instagram page that shares sort of the most Italian, the most bizarre Italian people that go on a bike. And it's really, really funny. Because you see the...
Palacci, can you spell that for us, please?
P-A-N-N-O-L-A-T-I. Yeah. You don't need anything more. That's it. Go look at that. Lots of answers there.
From Gordon Booth on Strava, can he, and I guess this means you, Palacci, can he compile a list of his favorite ciclismo terms so we can all sprinkle them into our cycling descriptions? I'd like to know if there's any ciclismo terms for rides we all do. For example, 1 hour full gas, effort, long slog up an alpine climb. If there aren't any, just get him to make some up.
Oh, it's tough. I should have been preparing this for a long time, but. I would say any cycling expression works, really. For example, one that I love comes from the past. They used to call the bike itself macchina.
The car.
Which is used for cars now. So it's really good. If the bike breaks down, mia macchina è andata. My car is gone. That's fun to me. I don't know.
This is always something that I don't cycle anymore. I'm always slightly paranoid about the fact that my sort of vocabulary to describe anything to do with cycling is becoming outdated, completely outdated, because I always fear that there's a kind of secret language that's been spoken mainly by people who are riding bikes and riding in groups and riding in clubs, not so much clubs anymore, but all sort of hipster secret sects, the kind of which you inhabit, Palachi. But yeah, maybe not, maybe my fears are misplaced. Anyway, from Connor on Strava, I'm getting tired of the narrative around Jonas not being the rider he was a few years ago. Watching today's stage on TNT, the commentary kept pushing that angle. Meanwhile, he wins the stage by a decent margin, takes pink and was breathing through his nose. Isn't it more likely he's just riding in a controlled, efficient way with an eye on the tour? Well, Connor, I tend to agree with you about him riding in a controlled, efficient way with an eye on the tour. I think I said earlier in the Giro, I didn't buy the fact that he was just at the Giro sort of preparing for the tour and riding with a sort of governor on. But the more I sort of spoke to the team over the course of the 3 weeks, the more I realized that there was maybe an element of truth to that, certainly in the way that they had looked at the Giro in advance and selected certain stages on which they were going to try to gain time, which broadly speaking is exactly what they did. So I think you're right. Palachi, you were involved in a bit of a social media storm this week with your... Due to your comments on Vingegaard. This was part of me, but actually sat back and I felt bad for you, but I also thought this is a bit of a rite of passage now for us journalists. Unfortunately, this happens to all of us at some stage now, particularly when you're working for an organization, i.e. us, who doesn't indulge in this kind of thing very deliberately. And I've talked about this on the podcast before. What am I talking about? Well, Palachi made some comments on our End of Giro podcast last Sunday, I think it was, just sort of summing up how Jonas Vingegaard and how his Giro win had been received and greeted by the Italian public. And they were pretty reasonable comments, delivered in a reasonable way, but they were extracted, divorced from their context, put in tweets, put in stories on these sort of aggregator websites, and it's kind of Italian journalist slams Vingegaard. It wasn't quite as blunt as that, but that was the idea. And yeah, as I said, Palachi, I think we all go through this now at some point, and it's a bit irritating.
Let me just say, I like Jonas Vingegaard, and the quotes were there, but yeah, when you do 20 hours of commentary on the road every day at the Giro d'Italia, and they just take 10 sentences and put them on like that, it's not fantastic. I don't know what to say.
Yeah. What was also interesting, Palachi, I looked at some of the comments on Twitter underneath. So I don't know who the first person to pull these comments out was, but I certainly saw a well-followed Twitter account lay out the quotes in writing, and then I think you responded sort of saying much of what you've just said, i.e. you know, I spoke a lot about Jonas Vingegaard over 3 weeks, and this was these comments are sort of taken out of context. And then people replied to your comment saying, well, what's your problem, you said it, didn't you, just own it. Very kind of vicious, a lot of the comments were. And again, it sort of, to a certain extent, it vindicates our approach and our sort of policy of not, for example, and it's to our detriment commercially, but of not extracting sound bites that are liable to rage bait or farm engagement on, and put them on shorts, put them on little clips and whatever. But we can't stop other people doing the same thing to us. You know, often it's purely the fact that it takes quite a bit of effort to do that, to go into the podcast. You have to listen to the podcast and you have to then transcribe it. And this is getting easier and easier with things like AI. But if we don't do that for people, on people's behalf, then often we sort of protect ourselves against that. If we were doing the sort of cutting up and putting in rage baiting kind of clips or viral clips that were sort of destined to go viral, then the problem would be much worse. This would be happening every week, that someone would be latching on to something we'd said and then writing a story about it. And it's just kind of, it's lazy on the part of colleagues who are doing this, but it's also a result of the lack of money and lack of investment that people have to do this because it's very cheap. You know, they're not going to races, they're not going to report on races, which costs a lot of money. They are sort of sitting at home and feeding on whatever they can find. Even that's comments from another podcaster, which really shouldn't be newsworthy, but in this case, they become it. So anyway.
I've got a question for you, Daniele, from Richard Northing, who writes on Strava. I have the last 2 weeks of August free in Europe with my gravel bike. Should I ride in the Veneto or in Denmark?
I don't know. I spent 4 days in Denmark, 5 days for the start of the Tour de France in 2022. Of course, you should go to the Veneto. Whether it's gravel riding or anything else, when in doubt, go to the Veneto. But actually, incidentally, I discovered a new part of the Veneto in the last few days of last week. I didn't know Lessinia very well. So the area sort of north of Verona, it's kind of the foothills of the Alps. It's a hilly and slightly mountainous area as well. And it's sort of on the west is Valpolicella, the wine-growing region. But in Lessinia itself, a lot of great gravel roads I discovered last few days. But famously in the Veneto, the Altopiano di Asiago has really excellent gravel roads. And I think they held, in fact, the European Gravel Championships a couple of years ago, if I'm not mistaken, up there. But there are a lot of great gravel roads in the Veneto, so I would definitely go there.
Not much to add. Yep, you're correct. Gravel roads are very good. Also in the eastern part of the Veneto towards Treviso. I've been riding my bike in Vicenza, my gravel bike as well. So yeah, in the Po as well. The Po, Chioggia, down towards Goro and all the Rovigo area, which is super flat, but gravel roads are good there.
Palacci from Luke D. Would Palacci's family consider a coffeeless edition of their prosciutto, dry aging it for the same time between Cofidis World Tour wins? Would that work, Palacci? And Cofidis are not the worst offender in terms of World Tour wins. I mean, there are other teams who have gone longer, certainly this season, who have gone longer between World Tour wins. But would that work? I mean, yeah, of course it was. You can. How long can you age? Can you dry age a prosciutto, Palacci?
I think you can't go much longer than 2 or 3 years, because otherwise some, you know, just some processes will not benefit, but do some damage to the meat, right? You know what I mean? So yeah, you can't, just like in cycling, you can't go too much time without, you know, having some meat out of the bone.
You couldn't have sort of Alberto Bettiol edition with 3 years between sort of Giro d'Italia. Well, we talked about these triennial Alberto Bettiol masterclasses in the Giro d'Italia. You couldn't wait 3 years. Probably not. Palacci from Tim Hamilton West on Strava. Your running routes look fab. How do you know where you're heading, or do you just literally explore and see where you end up? This has changed over the last 3 or 4 years because I now heavily rely on heat maps on Strava. Palacci, you use Komoot, and I often lampooned you. I mean, Komoot seems pretty decent. I prefer the graphics on Strava, but I was sort of lampooning you on Giro, referring to the Partito Comunista Italiano, which is a sort of play on the Italian Communist Party, but I was calling it the Comutist Party, and that was sort of synonymous for getting lost down, you know, on forest tracks where you kind of needed to bushwhack your way out of trouble. Because Komoot always seems to me to be more oriented towards something slightly wilder, Palacci. But I might be wrong, I don't use Komoot. So I think broadly, from what I could tell when we were running together, it was showing you the same trails and same roads that Strava was showing me, the Strava heat maps were showing me. Correct?
Yeah, I would say both are good. I don't know. Yeah, I like to get lost, actually. I like to get to be lost in the bushes. So yeah, it's fun. So
we generally were looking for altitude game, weren't we? I mean, I'm a glutton for punishment, bearing in mind what we've already said about you thriving on gradients of 10% plus. Notwithstanding that, we were trying to go uphill as much as possible. I mean, I wonder why I have this kind of gluttony for punishment or gluttony for also going uphill. And I mean, why do we climb? Why do people go on holiday or travel to the other side of the world just so they can go up higher climbs and further uphill than in their home environment? One is the challenge, obviously, but you also get much better views. The higher you go, you get much better views and you see more of the landscape. And I think that is a big part of the explanation for why I like going uphill and like ascending as much as possible. And we saw that on the Giro, didn't we, Palacio? We went to some fantastic places, particularly I'm thinking of the run we did in Monte Sant'Agata in Ticino. We got a fantastic view of the Lago di Lugano, way, way beneath our feet. And yeah, I sort of have this craving when we are on the grand tours to discover, and I think this is something we share, Palacci, why have we ended up working in cycling or being passionate about cycling, and we're both explorers, adventurers and of the outdoors, and I like to use those sort of 2 hours or hour of kind of downtime, us time that we get in the grand tours to take advantage of being in these fantastic places and to see as much of these places as possible, see even more than we get to see when we're following the race in the car. So yeah, that's kind of the main reason I run on the grand tours, as well as to sort of try and stay healthy.
Very interesting question that has to be asked to you, Daniele. John Crowder on Strava asks, why hasn't Pelacci's 30-minute special on Pokemon dropped yet?
Okay. Let's move on. I'm completely flummoxed by the Pokemon thing. But anyway, Palacci, if you want to explain to me what the fascination of Pokemon is, then go right ahead.
It's just fun. It's just fun to play. Still playing at Pokemon Go on my app on the phone. Yeah, listen, I'm a big Diamante guy. So fourth generation, the first 493 Pokemon are really my thing. The next following 500 are tough. So let's move on. By the way, Daniele, Moyin Islam asks, who are your top 5 non-Italian ciclismo riders? I've got a list here. Do you have one?
I can probably come up with one. Go on, give us your list.
So my list is number 5, Richard Carapaz. Number 4, Jonas Abrahamsen. Number 3, Isaac Del Toro. Number 2 is Mads Pedersen. Number 1 has to be Wout Van Aert. And I also have in horse category a guy who's on my screensaver, a guy I revere, I love the most. Horse category in the non-Italian ciclismo riders is Remco Evenepoel. What's your list? Curious.
I can think of 2 right off the top of my head. I mean, Moyen, I know that Moyen is was a man after my own heart. He was a huge, huge fan of Thibaut Pinot. And Thibaut Pinot, although he's been retired for 3 years, he would still be top of my list. Jan Christen, I would say, is pure ciclismo. Tadej Pogacar is pure ciclismo. He's the absolute essence of ciclismo, I would suggest. But Pelas, you look skeptical. You look a little less skeptical.
Very fun.
I'm going to limit myself to those 3 at the moment, but just can you enlighten us? Can you elaborate slightly on your fascination with Remco Evenepoel?
I just love how instinctive and how, just natural he is, right? He's super, super good. Looks very good on the bike. Very good. And, you know, it's fine not to be perfect. It's fine not to be, you know, how he has a history of cracking, of not being on top of every climb, not being on top of every sort of problem he has had. And he has a lot of up and downs, which is very ciclismo, of course. For example, when he crashed into the portiera della macchina. How do you say that?
Into the car door, yeah.
Yeah. And so I just love Remco, man.
Pelas, it strikes me that there isn't really a hipster sort of element of your definition of ciclismo. It doesn't have to be sort of contrarian, or it doesn't have to be kind of left field. Am I right?
You're correct. You can, and also there was a non-Italian So I had to, you know, leave out all the corners of the world, but yeah, so.
I'm curious, would you have been a Marco Pantani fan?
Oh, massive.
Yeah,
of course.
I was going to say, because I wasn't, probably for hipster reasons, because he was too popular for my tastes, which sort of turned me against him. And I went for the anti-Pantani, the anti-hero, which was Pavel Tonkov. You're also, Pelati, you're probably going to wince at this, but you're also pretty patriotic when it comes to cycling and supporting Italian riders and Italian teams.
Well, I feel like this is the closest thing we have to the Italian national team, right?
Mm.
So,
what, the Ciclismo team?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I'm not nationalistic when it comes to politics or voting or government. But listen, I like my Italians when it comes to, yeah, winning the Giro d'Italia or bike races or going to Giro di Francia and winning that.
Pelati, can I just go back one on our list? Steve Webb on Strava. Daniel, are your morning runs with Pelati really a fair fight? I noticed a distinct difference in kit, brackets, carbon shoes, aero socks, aero cap. We need UCI equipment regulations to make these runs a fair fight. Well, Steve, let's see. Is it really a fair fight? Pelati's how many years younger than me?
Maybe 16, 17.
Yeah, 16 years. And for the record, there's no carbon in the shoes that I wear. Don't use carbon plated shoes. Don't use aero socks. The cap is not an aero cap, Steve. I'll turn the question round on you. Is Michele Pelati, who is 28 years old, did you say 28 years old and weighs 58 kilos, versus my, I'm not going to say old, I'm, well, born in 1980 and weigh about 80 kilos. You tell us, Steve, if that's a fair fight on 20% gradients. Anyway.
We're close to the end, Daniele, but...
We are close to the end. 5 minutes.
There is this question from Andrew Young, who asks about sort of... Well, it was after the Gannification, he says, of the time trial and of the potential views that Ganna could have had for Ineos, well, Netcompany Ineos at the Giro d'Italia. And I think if you look at Filippo Ganna's Giro d'Italia, there's something to be said there, because Filippo Ganna has had a pretty unique Giro d'Italia, I would say, with not much action at all, apart from that time trial and the final stage in Rome. Listen, he's a very peculiar rider, underrated, I would suggest, but I probably expected a bit more from him in this Giro d'Italia.
Yeah, me too, Pelati. I think we discussed it a few times, didn't we, that maybe this is unfair. You kind of imagine that particularly in a race, in an inverted commas, weaker race than the Tour de France, Ganna could one day be capable of doing something like Wout van Aert did in the Tour de France in, for example, it was 2021, where he really sort of dominated that race to some extent. If you look at the number of stages where he was a protagonist, it was probably 13, 14 stages. And you imagine that could be the case for Ganna. But then, as a mitigating factor, Netcompany Ineos put a lot behind Timon Arensman in this Giro d'Italia, rightly or wrongly. And I don't know how much Ganna was sort of hamstrung by that. But there's been nothing really in Ganna's career which has suggested an appetite for or an ability or a sort of a capacity to offer that kind of all-action protagonism that we have seen on occasion from Van der Poel in Grand Tours or Van Aert. It will be interesting to ask him about that. Pelati, we're going to answer a couple more. This is a sort of travel one. Scotty McMorrin, Daniel, thank you for Girovagando. It's been a while since I've benefited from your advice. Please may you choose for us at the end of September for about 3 weeks, Piedmont and Lombardy or the north of Spain. Running, cycling, nice food and peacefulness. Could he add the South Tyrol to those choices? Pelati, where would you go? Piedmont / Lombardy or the north of Spain or Alto Adige, South Tyrol? I'll answer
it
in a second.
Wow, interesting. I will go, I was amazed by north of Spain when we visited it together last year for the Vuelta. All the Pyrenees area is really beautiful. But listen, what Piedmont and Lombardy have, in addition to what the nature brings and all of that, is culture, right? They've got great museums, great cities, and I think the north of Spain lacks a bit of that. I think Piedmont and Lombardy are a good pick if the sort of the goal is goes beyond, you know, just going in nature and cycling and running. If you want to see, you know, sightseeing or visiting, that's my choice. Yeah.
It really depends on the emphasis you want to put on your trip. I think Spain is far superior to Italy when it comes to sort of a road trip. And if you don't like a lot of traffic and you want to get the sense, I mean, in Western Europe, you don't really anywhere get the sense of pure wilderness. But Spain, you certainly get much bigger open spaces, bigger expanses of unspoiled landscape as well. And certainly more than in Piedmont. And Lombardy is a very congested area. And there aren't many places in Lombardy that are completely unspoiled. There are some, but there aren't many. In Piemonte, there are more, particularly if you go into some... We talked about it quite a lot in the Giro. A lot of the mountain valleys, so going sort of west from Cuneo, some of these valleys, they actually seem a little bit deserted and a little bit sad and a little bit sort of forgotten in some cases, but the nature is gorgeous. It's beautiful. So if that's what you want, then go there. And obviously the food in... And as you say, the culture in Lombardy and Piemonte... It's difficult to find that in a lot of parts of northern Spain. Certainly, you know, there are beautiful towns in places like Rioja and even the Basque Country and so on and so forth. But can be a little bit frustrating if you go to some of the naturally beautiful parts of northern Spain. So Asturias, Galicia, the towns are generally not as beautiful. And certainly Galicia, that's definitely the case. We've talked before about the in inverted commas, ugliness of Galicia. And it's something that Galicians themselves talk about in relation to their towns because of lack of building regulations and so on and so forth. So that's the sort of dichotomy of those two places, northern Italy versus, or Piedmont Lombardy versus northern Spain, I would say. Then South Tyrol, if you love the mountains and if that's what you're looking for, then go there. It's more expensive. The accommodation in that part of Italy is of a very high level. The restaurants are of a very high level. Obviously, it's German speaking and you feel more like you're in Austria than in Italy. But if you like that kind of cuisine and you love the mountains and the beauty of the mountains, particularly at that time of year, it's going to be a lot quieter than it will be over the next few weeks. So if it's a pure mountain experience then that you want, go to the South Tyrol. Next couple, Pelacci, before we go, or last two.
Let's go with Shua S. wrote on Strava, how do you wash and keep your kit clean during the Giro?
With great difficulty. It depends. We need good weather and we need a car with a back window because basically we hand wash clothes generally, hand wash running clothes generally, wring them out as best as we can, dry them as best as we can in the hotel room before we leave, and then we sort of put them on the back seat. What's that? I don't know what it's called. On the... on top of the boot, but inside the car. Anyway, and hope that over the course of the day they dry. But of course, that sometimes isn't the case. And the car does end up smelling like a locker room pretty quickly on some days. It's a challenge. It is a real challenge. And the best way to do it, but again, this is can seem a bit eccentric and antisocial, is to hang the washing out of the window. So literally trap it in the window and have it drying as we speed down the autostrada. Last one, but actually make it a good one. Can you pick a good one for us? Here's one.
Go ahead.
Noah Price, your wine glass rankings for each Grand Tour get a lot of discussion. I noticed that although the Tour has 2 5 stars, the Giro has none. Would you say the Giro has paled to the Tour this century, or as alluded to earlier, there's a love for the Giro and its unfulfilled potential that leave you wanting more? What would be needed for the hallowed 5 wine glasses, which has been the closest? Yes, it has paled, unfortunately, in terms of entertainment. Palazzi, you might quibble with this, but I do feel that the tour and the gap has got bigger over the last few years. We've seen a bigger sort of concentration of stars in the Tour de France, and the advent, well, the emergence of people like Pogacar, who have a very spectacular style of racing, have accentuated this difference between the Giro and the Tour. We've seen sort of two paradigms at the Giro, certainly as far as the general classification is concerned over the last few years. We've seen closer races lacking star quality, I would say, lacking a little bit of star quality. I don't want to belittle any of the winners or any of the protagonists of the last few years, but sort of riders that are a distinct level or two below the guys who are contending for the Tour. Or we've seen someone like a Pogacar or a Vingegaard going to the Giro and dominating and killing suspense after all suspense after, well, in Pogacar's case, maybe 2 days. In Vingegaard's case, maybe a week. And then we have also had, I feel, a lot of riders who've gone to the Giro with the idea that they are going to hopefully finish between third and fifth, or third and sixth, knowing that that will enhance their market value, and being kind of fairly unwilling to risk everything to try to win the race. And at the Tour de France, I just feel that because the stakes are higher and the potential win is higher. If you gamble everything and go for a stage win, or you gamble everything and you finish on the podium, then I think people are more inclined to take risks. Also, I think the Giro suffers from the fact that it's early in the season, and individually riders feel that they've got another big chunk of the year to come afterwards that can make or break their season. And so, again, they're not as willing to push all of their chips into the middle of the table. That's my sense. As well as, you know, obviously it's just that the level is not quite as high. And we sort of all know and understand the reasons why the best riders go to the Tour in the best form possible.
I've got one very final question for you.
Because I'm
not around really there. What made the 2003 Tour de France so special?
I'll preface this by saying I go back and look at a lot of my rankings and think that, as I said to someone on Twitter the other day, I must have been either drunk or high, and I don't really get drunk ever, and I've never taken drugs, so I don't know. I can't account for some of my rankings, and really what should be happening, this is what happens with wine, for example, and that's the sort of paradigm here, is that things get regraded. So, you know, something that looked like a 5-star at the time, if with hindsight now looks like a 3-star, I really should regrade them, but I haven't necessarily done that. 2003 Tour de France, well, it was just sensational in the sense that we had a subpar Lance Armstrong. And this was something that seemed inconceivable, that the previous 4 years had been so one-sided and so easy for Armstrong. It didn't seem as though he was ever going to be assailable. And then in addition to that, Jan Ulrich, his big adversary, was coming from a doping ban, although it was for ecstasy, a recreational drug. And also he was in a team that was really falling apart in the spring of that year, new team that he'd moved to. It became Bianchi, and it was falling apart in the spring, so it didn't even look as though he was going to go to the Tour de France. And then he arrives at the Tour de France, and it's the best Ulrich ever and the worst Armstrong we've seen for a number of years, and it just made it sort of scintillating and very tense. Armstrong won in the end, but there were moments of fantastic drama. The iconic image of Armstrong going across the field on a stage, which, you know, wasn't sort of billed as the Queen stage or one of the more exciting stages. So that added an awful lot of drama. And then Armstrong slowly, well, Ulrich crushing Armstrong in the big time trial to Cap Découverte, but then Armstrong slowly getting back into it, and you felt as though the clock was ticking for Ulrich. He really needed to crush Armstrong when he was down, and he didn't do it. Obviously, the big caveat to all of this, the big asterisk, is that we know now that Armstrong was doped, Ulrich was doped, and, you know, most of the other people who were competing for the top 10, certainly, if not top 50, whatever, most of them were also doped. So you might well argue that this particular Tour de France should be demoted, downgraded to a one star or a one glass or a no glasses. But I did try with all those rankings, I tried to say it as I saw it at the time. And that was how I saw it at the time. And very, very exciting indeed.
What a story. That's cool. Super cool. Listen to you and reading all these names. Gilberto Simoni, Alessandro Pitacchi won some stages. That's fun.
Yeah. A classic, Pelacci, before your time, young man. Anyway, Pelacci, we really got to finish there. Again, sorry to those who sent in questions that we haven't managed to get to. We've done our best to answer a fair few anyway, haven't we? Haven't we, Michele? And again, thank you so much for all of your feedback during and after the Giro d'Italia. It really did mean an awful lot. And I hope this interactive element to the podcast over the 3 weeks, it did also add a lot. It added a lot to our experience and it added a lot to the listeners' own experience as well. So well done. Well done, everyone, on that. Pelacci.
Yeah, thanks for it's were great, and we'll reconvene
some point down the road somewhere. Grazie mille, Michele.
Ciao, Danilo. Ciao.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney. Faccene in